Beloved MTV VJ, music exec, and radio personality Matt Pinfield has spent almost four decades in front of and behind the mic. He signed bands, interviewed Beatles, and had songs written about him. But now, he's having a different conversation. He's talking with friends and supporters across the entertainment industry about their journey and how he's found his voice again, being open about his recovery. This is Sound, Sobriety, and Success.
You know, my guest today is incredible. It's a guy that I love because we've been friends for so many years. And one of the beautiful things about doing this podcast is getting to get together with people that have been a big part of my life that, you know, we decided to take a different path in our lives and made the best of it. And, you know, a lot of guys that I ran with back in the day. But I got to say, I couldn't be more excited about having my guest today. It's interesting because we were both connected to one of our guests that we had on earlier, which was Duff McKagan, of course. And we'll get into that in just a little bit. But we all used to run together at different times, and now we're living a different life. And it's the most beautiful thing to be able to celebrate living and changing that way of life with the people that are just important to you. And we hope that everything that we do and talk about, you know, will resonate in some way with you. So I want to tell you a bit about this guy. My guest is an author, director, life coach, and interventionist. You might have seen on the hit TV shows New York Inc. and Bondi Inc. Tattoo Crew. He's my longtime friend, Mike Diamond. Mike, it's great to see you, man.
Dude, it's so amazing to see you.
You know, I look at us and I go, wow, you know, we're still here.
Yeah, we survived.
You know, we have gratitude every day when we wake up because we're just so happy not only to be alive, but to, you know, just be showing up for life, which is, and just, you know, spreading positivity, which is the thing that's so important to me. And it's, you are a beacon of positivity, and you've written this incredible new book, and we're going to talk about that too. But let's go through your history. I mean, it's great. We met, what, in late 1990s in New York City. I was on K-Rock at the time and working with a lot of local bands, and then we hung out a lot in the early 2000s. You had this incredible club called Snitch in New York City that you, your partners in that were the guys in Velvet Revolver. So you're talking about Stone Temple Pilots, Guns N' Roses. You know, we did gigs together where, you know, Sendog from Cypress Hill be playing and I'd be DJing sets there. And those were, of course, our partying days. But the great news is, you know, we both got out of it and you've literally just started celebrating 17 years. Yeah. Which is fantastic, you know? So let's talk about, so I can introduce you to people. Let's dive into your accent because you've got this incredible voice. You're from Perth, Australia originally, and came to the States around 97, and we met around that time. You know, I'm fascinated with the story, too, about how you ended up getting your green card, and it was a lottery. Tell me how that worked.
So it's a really crazy story. First of all, thanks for having me on. To see you and see us both sober together, it's pretty awesome.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? There's a lot of people we, unfortunately, are no longer with us. And you know what I mean? We made it through this incredible, it's chaos and storm, you know?
Yeah.
So it's a crazy story. And what I tell people, Matt, and I think the most beautiful thing about life is that we think we have a plan, but we don't. The purpose of life is to be authentic and follow your intuition. So I'm at acting school and I didn't have good mentors growing up and I moved from Perth to Sydney and my plan was always to move to America. So I go to this acting school and Hugh Jackman went there before me. So I'm like, the plan is go to acting school, get an agent, come to America, right?
Yeah.
I got sober at 19, but I'll be honest, I didn't understand alcoholism, drug addiction. And I had a really bad mentor and I ended up getting really messed up and started messing around with cocaine again and drinking. Cause I started very young at 12 years old. That's when I started really using at a young age. And one night this mentor of mine decides that it would be a good idea for me to hang out with him and another girl. And he took advantage of her and he practically like raped her. And I was too intoxicated and messed up to do anything about it. And the next morning, I went to her and said, what do you want me to do? And she goes, I shouldn't have been there. We shouldn't have been there. I'm just going to let it go. And intuitively, I'm like, no. He's a predator. So I went to another friend of mine. And not many people know this. And I said, she was at school with me. And And I said, what do I do? She goes, you need to stand up for her. Go to the dean. So I went to the dean and I said, hey, what do I do? He's got to go. I shouldn't have been there. We shouldn't have been there. And he's like, well, it's her word against his. And I didn't want to public shame her, right? I said, you know what? I'll just leave. Say it's on me and get rid of him, but I'll leave. I'll walk for her. So I walked, and it was just before graduation, and I'm walking down this mall in Australia, and I'm like, what have I done? And there was a clothing store that this Greek guy, I'm part Greek, I used to walk by, and they give me a hard time because I was going to acting school. I'm like, I'm going to ask him for a job. So I went into this clothing store, and I kind of bullshitted my, can you swear, right?
Yeah, of course you can.
Yeah, bullshitted my way into getting a job, and he basically put me on the spot. He's like, can you sell clothes? I said, kind of. And he said, well, if someone walks in and you can sell clothes to them, I'll give you a job. And a lady walked in, and I knew it was a menswear store, went to acting school, and I kind of said, oh, you're looking for something for your son or your husband? She said, my son. I said, perfect. And I looked in the window. It's like, you know what? I grabbed the outfit out of the window. I went into the change room, tried it on. She's like, I like it. He gave me a job. So I'm hustling, right? Selling clothes, doing this stuff. Out of nowhere, another lady comes in, and I had my racket going. And she said, what are you doing here? And I said, well, I'm going to move to America. And she said, you know what? You should enter the green card lottery. And I was like, the fuck are you talking about, a lottery? She goes, yeah, you can win a green card in a lottery. I'm like, this woman is on peyote, green card lottery. So I was getting stoned the next day with the guy that I worked with, him addressing the shop windows, acting like assholes. And I see the shop's closed and it's an open air wall. And I see her with bags for the store. So in my mind, I'm like, she's going to return the clothes because I sold her clothes for a husband. So I hide in the back and she's banging on the window. And I'm like, I'm not here. And the guy's like covering my ass. Like, what do you want? She's like, is Mike here? And he's like, are the clothes okay? She goes, yeah. I bought him the green card lottery ticket. He's like, what? I come out. I said, look, I'm not going to lie to you. I was hiding in the back because I thought you wanted to return the clothes. She goes, I don't know who you are, but you seem like a special person. I bought you this ticket. I went to the embassy. It's legit. Gave me a hug. Send it in. I went to the embassy and said, I'm not a crackhead, right? You can win a green card in the lottery. The guy laughed at me. He goes, yeah, but you're not going to win. It's one in a billion chances to win a green card. 6 months later, the embassy contacted me and I won a fucking green card in a lottery. And the purpose of this is this. If I didn't stand up for that girl and do the right thing and follow my intuition, the universe paid me 100 times of what I thought was my plan.
Yeah. I believe that 100%.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I would have followed the linear path, stayed in Australia, probably going to acting school, but I would have lived in regret and shame that I didn't stand up for her and show her that she was worth something. I got a fucking green card.
And that's incredible. And then, you know, it's amazing. And you're a teenager still, but eventually you moved. How old were you when you ended up making the move to Miami? How old were you?
24. I was young. 24. Nothing. I had nothing. Not a pot to piss in or a window to throw it out.
Yeah.
No social media. I couldn't go on, let me find Australian Facebook friends trying to make it in America. I landed with nothing. I had nothing, Matt. I was like, oh, I guess I'll figure it out.
Yeah. But you end up landing this sitcom, you know, Grapevine.
Yep.
With David Frankel, right?
David Frankel directed it. And that, you know how that came? So I was working in a jewelry store and a guy came, I was selling jewelry and this guy trying to hustle. I was doing demos, going to acting auditions. And this guy walks in and he's like, what are you doing here? I'm like, I'm trying to make money. And he's like, dude, I run a club down the street. Why don't you come and get a job? I said, I don't work at a nightclub. He's like, $250 a night. I said, to do what? Is it legal? I had a little apartment for like $250 on South Beach back then. He's like, yeah, just open a VIP rope. I said, to do what? He's like, let people in and out. I said, I'm your fucking guy.
You're there. Yeah. That's incredible.
So, and then what happened was I got the hustle going because I'm like, oh, America's about tips. Australia's socialism. You don't make tips in clubs. And then producers started to meet me and different people because they wanted to go to the clubs. And the guys from Chaos in New York that had Chaos in Watt Street came to Miami, discovered me, hired me as the door guy. They didn't even really know me. They just gave me a job. And Frankel was looking for a musician and he met me and said, hey, I've got an audition tomorrow. We're looking for a musician. Can you act? I said, yeah, I went to acting school. He did the velvet rope thing. There was 1,000 people in line, pulled me from the back, did the audition, and I landed the role on the sitcom.
That's incredible.
Yeah. All by chance.
Yeah. And then tell me when you made that actual move to New York around.
So New York, I had to make the move strategically because what I wanted to do is I knew the guys from Chaos were opening up on Houston Street.
Yeah.
And they said, if you come to New York, we'll make you the door guy. So I became the New York door guy. And back then there was Wass, Allison, King. Like, I wasn't a New York guy. And they're like, and then Amy Sacco hired me at Bungalow 8.
Yeah.
And then they put me on Sex and the City. I was actually the door guy on Sex and the City and Bungalow 8. And what really, I was kind of in and out of my sobriety, Matt. But as soon as the towers came down, it was a wrap.
Yeah. I remember because it's that crazy feeling, you know, that has a lot to do with why I went off the deep during the pandemic, too. That uncertainty, that craziness, that uneasiness. I don't want to use anything as an excuse.
No, you just nailed it. That book.
Know, yeah.
When I start the book, right, yeah. I literally say, I swear to God, the same feeling of isolation when you were in New York to when the pandemic hit, that's what triggered that book.
Yeah.
I'm telling you, people don't get it. If you're in New York, you understand that. When you're in New York or you're in a big city and the towers are coming down, the pandemic was global. September 11th was New York. We felt like we were under attack. It was the scary. I'm an Australian kid from nothing, and I'm like, they're blowing up trade centers. I still have a picture. I ran out because I worked a shift at Bungalow 8. I have a picture, a Kodak picture that I got it, of 13th Street and 1st Avenue where I lived in the East Village, and I've got a shot of where the towers are blown up, and I ran and had the disposable, you know, we go with the coda or whatever, and I made him make the pictures for me. I still have those pictures.
It's amazing. I mean, I know that feeling. I was down there living on John Street. You know, I'd only been there for 10 days. So I moved in on September 1st with my baby daughter, who's now, you know, she's now, you know, 23, but she was a year and a half. And we moved there, and she was a toddler. And, you know, I was going to work at Columbia Records when, you know, I became vice president of A&R there. But, you know, it was funny because it was crazy. She was supposed to be in that Battery Park daycare that morning where the parents didn't know if their kids were alive or dead for 8 hours. You imagine, like, I just kept saying, I'm surprised I didn't have a heart attack. But she wasn't. She had an earache the night before, and so we didn't bring her in to the daycare that day. She was with us. We did have to evacuate. We had to leave our building. Never went back to live there. You know, there was damage to the building. I felt it was really unsafe. We moved out, and the rest is history. I mean, but it was, what an insane morning that was in that period. I will never forget. But I am telling you, one thing I was grateful for is that I was with my wife at the time and my child and not somewhere else out of my head. You know what I mean?
Oh, my God. Imagine that.
Thank God. Like, I was there to be there for them and get them out of the city. You know, because of the World Trade Center, when they came down, the tunnels were both closed off.
Yeah.
But, you know, the Midtown Tunnel going out to Queens and Long Island was open for 3 hours. The George Washington Bridge was open for 3 hours. So we kept our car, luckily, on 2nd and 38th Street. And I went up and got it and eventually drove out and stayed out there, you know, in Jersey where I was from, just to find, you know, we just got a hotel and the clothes on our backs, baby formula, like in a bottle to feed a baby, and a stroller. That's all we had, and our wallets.
Isn't that crazy about it? It's serious. It's real stuff. It's nuts.
It was unbelievable, but, you know, it was an incredible morning. And that time, and, you know, I can just say, but you celebrating 17 years is so incredible. I've got to also ask you, so you were splitting your time between Miami, you were in L.A., you were in New York, and you had a bunch of other projects going on at the time. But, I mean, you know, we were definitely using back then and, you know, quite a bit. Yeah. So tell me a bit about that.
Oh, I was out of my mind, Matt. I mean, look, let's be honest. I was saying to someone the other day, right? The only thing that separated me from other users is I had this ridiculous discipline. Like, I would do an 8-ball of cocaine, but I would do it from 10 till 4 or 5 in the morning. And then get up, like, walk my dogs and go to the gym like it was normal behavior. It's out of my fucking scone. Yeah. And like, I try to tell someone, look, you're a 24-year-old kid. You move to New York. You move to Miami. You go from not knowing anyone to running the hottest club in the world in Miami, Chaos. Then you move to New York, right? You're running the hottest clubs. After September, they open Pangea, Michael Alt makes me a fucking partner, right?
Yes.
I'm doing fistfuls of cocaine, right? I'm out of my mind. I've got access to everything. I'm making $4,000 or $5,000 a night, right?
Yeah.
Half's going up my nose. Like, I'm just, you know, no, there's no boundaries. No one's telling you to slow down. No one's telling you to stop. You know what I'm saying? So it's like, then I help I introduce Army James to Charlie Corwin. They create Miami Yink. And then, now here's what Snitch was created, and no one knows this. Brett was the catalyst from Fuel.
Brett from Fuel, who was one of the owners singers. As well.
Yeah, he was the catalyst. He was, Brett got screwed. Brett helped put it together. Brett came to me when Fuel was on a hiatus. I think Hemorrhage was number one. They were killing it. And he said, I'd really like to do something else. And we would hang out. I had was partners in a place called Dorsia. We'd drink. And I said, you know, there's this Greek restaurant on 21st Street. It was on the second floor because we had this restaurant, Vela. I'm like, I think I can convince the Greek owners on Park Greek to give us the space. Now, I should have protected them better. I was honest, right? Yeah. And he goes, I'll call Duff. He called Duff. And my partner at the time was a dick, and they rushed everything because they knew Velvet Revolver was coming to town.
Yeah.
Duff called Scott and said, hey, do you want to be involved? They had a minor percentage, but their names on it made it huge.
They did. I mean, you know,
made the place.
I'd come in there and, you know, they'd all be there. You know,
yeah. Like
Slash,
and
Duff.
Everyone. And everyone would play there.
Kushner, you know?
And you were there opening night.
Yes.
There was 400 people in a second floor walk up with no exits. That was a fire hazard. Like if something
we
all could have died.
Yes.
And I was like, is the roof going to collapse?
People were going nuts.
Nuts. No one could believe Velvet Revolver was playing there, right?
Yeah.
And then, you know, I didn't understand what we created because I just wanted a place. The whole goal was this. I worked at all these fancy clubs, Matt, and I was like, it sucks for musicians because I was a big lover of music, right? So all the cool guys, Johnny Tempesta, Rob Caggiano, Eddie Wall would come to the cool places and I'd let them in. Yeah. Renee, everyone, Allison, Hagendorf. I was like, I want to let my rock and roll. I love these people, right? Charlie Walk, everyone, you, Booker. So I was like, well, what happens if I fill a room and I bring everyone and then we put on a band and we have a DJ? They're like, oh, it doesn't work like that. I'm like, oh, I think I can fill the room. So it was kind of a fluke.
Yeah.
Because you go to CB's and then leave.
Yeah.
I wanted to create the event and make the bands the cherry on top, and then you hung out and like an after party, like a mixer.
It was. It was amazing because, you know, you'd see the bands do a set, but, you know, then I'd start DJing.
Yeah, and then like, come think about this, Matt. You would come in just for like a case of beer, and Huey from Fun Loving Criminals and Sindog, and everyone just would show up, and Corey Taylor from Slipknot and Hoobastank, even your friend. I don't remember his name. I don't know if you remember this. Your friend was managing the Killers, or he was a guy from William Morris, and I didn't know who the Killers were.
Yeah.
And you called me, and you said, hey, man, they've got this band. It was the Bravery and the Killers. I can't remember his name. And he's like, he's going to come down and see you. And I'm like, I got him, or whatever. I didn't know who they were. And he's like, could we do a set? And I'm like, yeah, okay. I'm like, who's this band? And it was the Killers. And they hadn't blown up yet. And I was like, oh my God, this band is so incredible. Oh my God. And he was like, yeah, cool. And he left. And then months later, they're like, dude, that was the Killers, that band. I'm like, what band? He goes, that Killers. I go, what are you talking about? I'm so out of my mind on coke. And I'm like, oh yeah, Matt knew the guy. He just said, go down and see my boy Mike. But I don't know who, I can't remember his name. He rang me because of you and the Killers and the Bravery played there.
Yeah, which was amazing.
On a favor.
Yeah.
Just go down and see my boy. Let him warm up. No one will know.
Yeah, that was how crazy it was.
Yeah.
And it would jam. People were, it was.
Jam. And it was so, you'd never get it again because there was no social media.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true.
It was so much fun.
It was, because you had to go out and experience and meet people. And that was the thing. You had to socialize. No, and, you know, and it made people less awkward about that, which I think was a cool thing. I mean, obviously, we were partying a lot at that period of time. But there was still that side of it where we loved music so much. We were spinning great music. People were dancing. We were having a good time. And there was a lot of fun involved in that. And Snitch was such a cool place. You even threw like a party for me for my birthday.
Yeah.
Remember? And then we were all eating next door. Like there was that other restaurant.
Bella. Yeah,
right.
So we did the restaurant. We went upstairs and got blinded.
Yeah, it was great.
Yeah.
You know, and I always say to people, like, look, it wasn't always, I don't want to be that guy who's a naysayer, says it wasn't always bad. We did have a lot of fun at times, but it stops being fun and it becomes detrimental and unsustainable lifestyle is what it comes down to.
You know,
and you're not clear.
No.
Like, that's the thing that you miss is the clarity.
And you know what it is, Matt? It's like I remember saying to a friend of mine that came to visit me, and he couldn't believe you did you did something with Velvet Revolver and Korn. It was something in Long Island and Papa Roach.
Yeah.
I think you were hosting it.
Yeah.
And then you said to me, what are we doing afterwards? And I'm like, I don't know. And so I got like a big bus and everyone piled on the bus.
Yeah.
And you're like, I'll bring everyone back. You brought everyone back. I remember. Yeah. And we were partying so hard with Fieldy and everyone. And my friend goes, he's like, what is this? And I was like, well, it's just what we do. And I think there was a Tuesday night. There was a Roselands party and you call me and you're like, come to Roselands. It was Tuesday. K-Rock was doing something.
Yeah.
It's Tuesday, right? And we're partying hard on a Tuesday. And then there was a Wednesday, and then he goes to me, and it was like Thursday night. He's like, dude, we've gone every day. Like, what is Saturday night? And I go, every night is Saturday night in New York City.
It was. It really was. I mean, we were going hard.
We did it.
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing about working, you know, in the music business at that time. We were just going wild every single night. You know what I mean? It was. And it, you know, and the great thing is that, you know, we'll both be the first to admit that eventually it starts to take its toll on your health and everything else. And you know, and certainly with me, it was one of those situations where one of the things we talked about, you and I, you know, before we even got on here on the podcast was how great it is to show up early, always be a person of your word and be there, you know, because that's for a while. You know, when you were younger, like you were talking about, you know, I would still do the same thing. I would party all night and then get up and go, like literally with 2 hours sleep, if that, and just keep rocking. And eventually got to the point where I was not showing up or not showing up on time or calling in. And, you know, that has a major detriment to your career, to your level of, you know, not being dependable and not having a respected word.
Yeah.
And I had to do a lot to turn that around. You know what I mean? I did. You know what I mean? Because it was not that people didn't like me because I had a good soul. I was kind and I was good to people and I wasn't an asshole. But, you know, I had to turn people's perception around about me that I'm a guy who shows up and does the best job he can do that day, the best version of yourself you can be. And that took time and it took effort. You know what I mean? It really does. But I feel great about that now because I can actually say, you know what? It's doable. You know, for anybody who's listening to Mike and I, if you think that like you've done so much damage, you can't turn things around. Certainly there are consequences and some things maybe don't, you know, obviously, but one door closes, another one opens and you'll find that there's nothing better than being clear and having that clarity in your life. I love that, Mike. I think it's the greatest. And that's why I'm grateful every day, and you and I both have an incredible positivity that we roll with.
Yeah, I always tell people if Robert Downey Jr. can go from jail and smoking crack to Iron Man, that's the perfect contrast, right?
Yes.
Crackhead to Iron Man.
Absolutely.
From doing the work.
It's 100% true, you know, and he is, we both know him, and, you know, he's such a
legend.
Great guy.
The legend.
We love him and think he's just an incredible guy. I mean, I remember him calling me, you know, to reach out to see if I wanted to connect in New York when he go to do Silent Live. He called me up and he goes, Matt, it's Downey. He goes, dude, I want to know if you're around. You want to get together and hit a meeting. He's just, I love
so
him.
So good.
He's just so great.
So good.
Let's talk about all that. You've done so many cool projects too, Mike. I mean, let's talk about, you did stand-up comedy.
Yep.
You know what I mean? What was that like? Because a lot of people in stand-up comedy, I know a lot of comedians, I know a lot of sober ones now that are clean and sober that I socialize with on a regular basis. But there are a lot of people that it's the same thing. It's part of that lifestyle and being out at night and doing everything.
You know, I'll be honest with you. I did it more. When I was at acting school, I was very good at improvisation. And I was taking a break I was trying to sell a show at the time in 2009. It was a comedy show, and it was before the Ink shows came, Miami Ink. And then when I walked away. Scott and I were shooting a pilot, and I kind of just like, yeah, I got sober, and I was like, yeah, I can't. Thank God VH1, they wanted Bottaducci. I got sober. I don't want to do it. I would have died. I would have died. If I would have kept going like that, there's no way I would have survived. So I got this to itch. I was like, you know what? It's the greatest stage in the world, comedy. You can't lie. So I had an agent at the time. I said, book me. And they're like, you can't do your first gig at the Comedy Store. I was like, yeah, I can. Because if I don't do it, I suck. And if I'm good, they'll hire me. And I did a warm-up show at a place called The Pig and the Whistle on Hollywood Boulevard.
Yeah.
And I had someone call the Comedy Store. I kind of bullshitted and said, oh, I'm representing this guy from Australia. He's on tour. Complete lie, because I was in from New York. And they sent a scout down to look at me. And they're like, hey, your agent called us. You're kind of funny. Do you want to try out in the belly room with this guy, Vargas Mason? There's a spot. There's a comedian. And he's like, can you bring people? I said, I can fill the room. So I rang everyone I knew in LA, and we went to the belly room, and I was watching the comedians, and they were bad. I was like, they suck. They really suck. And I just don't give a fuck. I'm just going to tell jokes, and I don't care. And the guy came up to me. He goes, can you save this? The people are walking out. I go, well, I brought most of the people because they think I'm going to fail. I'm like, I'll rock this. And I did like an incredible 8 minutes. And he goes, dude, you're part of my team. So I literally, my first, second gig, I was getting paid, and I was part of his like crew. So we do the belly room, and then every 2 weeks we do the main stage. And at the time it was so cool. So Paulie Shore had Whitney Cummings, Chris DeLeo, I think it is, and Rogan, all those, they were in the original room. And I would sneak in and I go, oh my God, this is so cool. I would watch their sets. And then what happened, Matt, was really crazy. An agent from Gersh came and saw me, and they really liked me. And I sat with my sponsor and I said, look, I like this, but this is not my calling. Like, I'm good at it, but it's fun, but I'm not going to be a comedian. He's like, well, what do you want to do? And I was like, I got to go and help people. And he's like, what do you mean? I said, like, sober coaching, you know, companion work, intervention, something in that. And he's like, okay. And, you know, he's like, I'll make a call. And it literally was like trial by fire. I called a lady that was like hiring sober companions, the top of the top. And like, let's be honest, we know a lot of people. And she's like, can you really go? Will you go anywhere? And I'm very good at modeling behavior. So this is what I teach people. If I go to you, Matt Pinfield, and I know you've been on air for 110 years, and I know you've ran record labels, I shut up and I sit next to you and I don't say a word and I do exactly what you do. I model brilliance and excellence, right? I just shut up. I just shut up and do the work. And I watch you and I study you and I ask questions. And if you give me advice, I don't question it. So I studied a guy called Warren Boyd, they did a movie about him called The Cleaner. And he was this legendary guy that would do, they call executive interventions, where it's like you find someone, you get them into treatment. And I just like studied everything and I started reading. And then I would take the calls. The older guys wouldn't want to go and find someone and wouldn't do the interventions on the fly. And I was like, I'll be the guy. If I have to lay on a detox floor for 3 or 4 days, I'll do it. I want to be the most reliable guy coming up. And then it just became a thing, dude. Call Mike, call Mike, call Mike. And then I got certified as an interventionist, right? And I studied the Johnson approach, which is you bring people in, you read letters, and then, but it's more of a surprise.
Yeah.
But I had the background because of all, I'm so lucky, like all those Hollywood people trusted me. They're like, we know this guy from the club business.
Yeah.
Get him. We can trust him. If he's with someone, they're not going to know. And I get calls from pretty heavy people. I'm like, I got it. Don't worry. It won't go in TMZ. I got you.
Yeah.
And that's, it just became just being that guy. And then what was so great is I came out saying I was sober. And a lot of people go, don't do that. It's not the rooms. I'm like, oh, I don't give a fuck about that. I don't want to tell people if I'm sick and suffering.
Yeah.
I'm not calling anyone out. My background in acting and comedy, I found a niche because I'm like, wait, I love Tony Robbins and all these guys, but they're really not addicts like me. Like, I can add some comedy and tragedy, but tools in delivering something empowering.
Yes.
You know what I'm saying? Yeah. Like, I can be like, I'm a crackhead. I'm an ex-crackhead. I said, you don't do it. So who gets called for the high schools? I do. Because they're like, dude, this guy used to snort cocaine and do crack. The kids are going to listen to him over someone saying, just do, say no to drugs.
Yeah.
I'm like, I'll tell you why you say no.
Yeah.
It's not free, freebasing. It costs you your life.
Yeah. Like, yeah. Ultimately, it's expensive, and then it costs you your life and everything else that you care about, right? Exactly.
So it's like, it's so crazy, and you'll understand this, like Matt Pinfield that started as a VJ, right?
Yeah.
It, now you look back from starting as a DJ in college to VJing to running record labels. Like, it all makes sense now of why I had to do all these great things to make me who I am today.
Yeah, absolutely. You know? And it's those experiences. That's great, you know? I think that stuff is so incredible. And, you know, we talked about Scott Weiland, somebody that we both mutually loved. Scott was, Scott really had a great heart. He was an incredible talent, right? I mean, he was just, he had the swagger, he had the voice, he had the range, and he was so special. So you and I were both, that was a hard one for both of us. Ugh, you
know? Horrible. Horrible, yeah. Because you know that you and I have suffered trauma.
Yeah.
And when someone just can't get well, it hurts us to see that.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Oh, absolutely.
And it hurts you even more. Especially like I remember someone sent, I remember we stopped talking about 18 months before he passed.
Yeah.
And I remember watching, someone sent me, I think it was Vaseline, and he was singing and I couldn't watch it. It was like he was Muhammad Ali in his last fight. And I was like, he's not going to make it. Like, you know, when you could see like the drug, and then we talk about drugs, like here's the difference, right? If my son comes up to me and goes, Dad, I want to do cocaine, I'm like, son, there's just no point. There's just no point. You're not going to go and drink 9 espressos and you're going to crap yourself and feel paranoid.
Yeah.
that's what you're going to really feel like, right? It's not, it's like, you don't need cocaine, right? I'm telling everyone right now, you do not need to do meth.
Yeah.
I've got ADHD. I don't do Adderall, right?
Yeah.
You don't need meth. You don't need cocaine. You don't need fentanyl. If you get prescribed oxys for surgery or something, go to someone that knows how to prescribe it, right?
Yeah.
You don't need these disempowering drugs unless you, especially cocaine and fentanyl, you don't need them. There's no point in the world to take them, right?
Yeah.
So when I see someone like Scott, like going like that, I just go, oh my God. And then I see him singing, or I see a guy like Lane Stanley.
Yeah.
When you look at these guys.
Lane and Scott were those guys that everybody was saying, you know, they were just waiting for it to happen.
It's
just
so heartbreaking.
That broke my heart. I didn't want to hear that. And even though I knew there was a little bit of truth in it with Lane, because it had been a long time, and it was, you always hoped that they would
turn it around
because others have done it. I mean, we're perfect examples of that. But we, of course, only have one day, 1 hour. But again, I also love the fact that you share, as we both do, the fact that we are in recovery, that we are alcoholics, drug addicts, because, aren't doing it now, but no longer do it. But I don't mind, I don't need to be anonymous because I want to help others.
Matt, I got off the phone to there was a kid that I got into treatment, and he goes to me, and the guy's gonna leave treatment. I'm like, no, he's not. Have him call me. Gets on the phone to me. I'm going to leave. I'm like, no, you're not. He's like, why? And I'm like, put the timer on. He's like, why? And I'm like, I'm going to talk to you for 20 minutes. And I guarantee you, I'll bet you what I have, because you don't have anything, that you're not leaving. He's like, okay. I said, how long are you sober? He said, 3 weeks. I said, well, so am I. He's like, you got 17 years. I said, no, I got 3 weeks. I said, it's just this moment on the phone, right?
Yeah.
He's like, oh, shit. I said, see, yesterday's gone. I don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. I'm on the phone with you right now. I said, but here's the thing. You don't have a guy like me in your corner. I say, you've got a guy now you can call. Do you want to use? Of course you want to use. I'd want to use. But you know now that you do fentanyl and you'll die. And you'll die a horrible death. So you're not using today. That's it. You're not using today. You're going to substitute the disempowering choice for an empowering choice.
Yeah.
So what could you do now? He goes, I can listen to music. I said, great. I could eat something healthy. I said, great. And that's what I tell people. Don't worry about quitting. Substitute.
Yes.
right?
You have to substitute. That's what it is. It's such a big part of it. And that, you know, and I agree with you 100% because that's the thing for me is like, I made music and doing other things because music was the first love anyway. Before I even thought about drinking or doing drugs, I was in love with music from the time I was a kid when I heard rock and roll and when I heard soul music then, you know, back as a little boy, you know, in the 60s and in the early 70s. I got to say that that was the thing that gave me the first joy. That's the first high I remember.
Yeah.
Is music. You know what I mean? It's rock and roll. That feeling it gave me was the most beautiful feeling, the most incredible feeling. Nothing else felt like that.
Yep.
I still feel like that when I hear a song that just blows me away. Like when I hear a new song and I get that feeling that it gives me that it's like no other because there's magic in it.
Yep.
There's beauty in it.
Yep.
And it's spiritual. And I think that that's the thing that's amazing. It's coming back, getting back in touch with that. But as you said, it's really important too in early recovery and then in continuous, you know, way of life and continuous living to have something else to substitute it for. And surrounding yourself as you can with as many good people that are doing, that are making the right choices, you know?
I call them in the book engines and anchors.
Yeah.
So there's a famous story about a little boy and he's on the a jetty and there's an old man fishing and he says to the old man, hey, you've got to put a lid on the basket. There's crabs in the basket. And he said to the little boy, I'm going to teach you a lesson of life. And he walks him over and there's no lid and they're all crabs running around. And one crab tries to get out and all the crabs bring him down. And he said, that's why you got to surround yourself with the right people because the wrong people will pull you down. And I call them engines and anchors. An engine is me.
Yeah.
I drive you. I inspire you. I put wind in your sails and I make you feel good. An anchor will try to drown you and hold you back.
Yes.
You've got to surround yourself with people that ignite you and make you feel good, right?
They
don't destroy you.
Yeah, not people that are sitting there judging you and putting you down. And you know, that's one of the reasons why so many people, I think, sometimes relapse is they are in relationships or around people that just aren't used to not having that upper hand because of this person who's out of control with alcohol or drugs.
Yes.
So it's different for them, but you mean you have to literally do your best and you got to get away from those people. But I've had a couple people out of my life that are just really negative and have so much negative.
Yeah, they're toxic.
Energy.
You know, look, here's the worst thing that people don't want to hear. They say blood's thicker than water, right?
Yeah.
But if the blood is poisonous, get a blood transfusion.
I agree 100% because sometimes it is family.
Yeah. Oh, sometimes they're the biggest anchors in the world.
Yeah, because
they don't want to see you shine.
Yeah. There
you
are people that don't have the your you know, and
best interest.
It could be one person, it could be many, but a lot of times when they talk about people, places and things, it makes complete sense. That may sound like a cliches or but it's so true.
It is.
Because you have to get those negative people out of your life. It's unbelievable. And the longer you stay clean and sober, the more you will see the clarity of those people and, you know, and then surround yourself with positive people. So those things that you can't necessarily control in your life, those moments, at least the things that you can, you do something about, right?
And 1,000%. You can control your rituals and routines.
Yes.
That's the key. That'll change your life. If you get up in the morning, okay, and you write down the first thing, how you feel. If it's chaos here, it becomes clarity here.
Yes.
Okay? So I'm anxious. Well, why am I anxious? Write down why you're anxious. Write down things to be grateful for. Then sit down quietly and do some breath work. Learn to breathe correctly, diaphragmatically.
Yeah.
There's no one way or two ways. Just learn to be peaceful and calm before you start the day. Don't pick up your phone, right? Then move your body. Stretch it a little bit, right? Get it? That's calling a healthy dose, right? Endorphins in your body. Go for a walk, do a little exercise, do a little stretching, read something positive, information in, information out.
Yes.
Right?
Absolutely.
Read something positive, read something informative, right? Then people say, do I do cold showers? I do warm and a little cold. Why? Makes me feel good, wakes me up. I do all that first before I even check my phone or an email.
Yeah.
Because then I'm responding, not reacting.
Yeah. And, you know, it's really interesting that you just said that because that's one of the things that I learned when this last time, you know, as I come up on my third year sober, right?
Congrats.
I'm 3 years sober in the beginning of May. And I want to say that one of the things that I learned was to respond instead of reacting. Because when you, and it's so important. I think it's a lot that people know that it's really important to do that, because you that way you get with yourself and you give yourself some time to think. Because, you know, one of the big problems with texting and social media and phones is when you react emotionally right away, you will regret a lot of those things. There was a song years ago by General Public, Tenderness. You know that whole line, words like conviction can turn into a sentence. You know, there's like, you know what I mean? It's so you will say some things that you might regret. Give yourself a chance to really think about how you react to the things that are going on around
yeah.
you. Excuse me. But, you know, right?
Yeah.
It's unbelievable.
There was a I think it was either Franklin or Roosevelt. He said that when he would get in an argument with a statesman or a congressman or whoever, he would write it all on paper and he would then take the envelope and write it to whoever it was for. And he said, I'm going to leave it in my desk for 2 weeks. In 2 weeks from now, I'll reread it and feel if I should send it. He never sent a letter.
That's amazing. I love that. If it's Roosevelt, it's great.
Yeah, I think it was Roosevelt, because he knew that. Because remember, like, you always hear people say, I wasn't thinking.
Yeah.
That means the emotions have hijacked us. The primitive part of our brain have taken over, right? Fight, flight, freeze, or for us, feed.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
So if you breathe diaphragmatically, they call it box breathing in the Navy SEALs, or you see a UFC fight or a boxing match, the first thing the corner man says is breathe.
Yeah.
Breathe. Because he knows if you breathe, you regulate your sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system. You go from, I want to fucking kill you, to, hey, let me think rationally. The danger's gone. Why would I write that? Why am I so angry? Why am I triggered?
Yeah.
That gap between stimulus and response, that gap in between, saves a lot of jobs.
It does.
How about you say that tweet? Maybe I won't say that tweet.
Yeah, right.
How about I say this? How about I say that?
Saves a lot of jobs and saves a lot of relationships, too.
Lives.
You know,
like,
and lives.
You could say some stuff.
People say things that they just cannot take back, and then once it's out there, it's out there.
We've seen people, right, that you're like, well, did you really write that? Did you really say that?
Yeah.
I wasn't thinking. No shit.
Yes, exactly. I mean, there's musicians we've seen, certainly politicians. I mean, everybody. But even on a very on a personal level, a peer to peer, person to person, it's so great to take the time to step back and think things through before you do that.
Yep.
Respond, don't react. I love that. I think that's such a great part. Mike, I got to talk to you more too about the book, because I love this book. It's called A Dose of Positivity: Tools, Techniques, and Strategies to Live Life on Your Terms.
Yep.
Explain to me, there's this really cool thing that you talk about with what DOSE stands for.
So the acronym for DOSE is dopamine, oxytocin, serotonin, and endorphins. And if you look at those four brain chemicals, is we're all searching for a dose. Because human behavior, right, and motivation is the simplest thing, and anyone that listens to it will understand it. Every human being on this planet has two motivations: avoid pain and gain pleasure.
Yes.
So how are you going to get your dose? There's empowering ways to get the dose, and there's disempowering. So when you feel threatened, when you feel stressed, right? Come home, you work all day, your dopamine receptors drop, and you see the donuts in the fridge, you have a fucking pack, because they're called circles of death.
Yeah.
It's a quick reward. You're not going to sit there and make yourself a nice steak and some greens and mashed potato, because you need to spike the dopamine.
Yeah.
So the world we live in is based on instant gratification, right?
Certainly.
Quick fixes. Why do you think these apps work? Because we're constantly searching for dopamine, reward. Now, oxytocin is community. Oxytocin is meeting with you, community, pets, and love. That's the love drug, right?
Yeah.
Serotonin, a lot of people don't realize, is status, feeling good about yourself. And what people don't realize is 90% of your serotonin is actually in your gut.
That's, I mean, you know, it's amazing what people don't, they talk about gut health.
It's the most important thing.
And
gut health is the most important thing, and people don't understand the mind and gut connection.
Talk to us more about that, because I find that it's so interesting, and I think people need to know that.
So the thing is, what people don't understand is we are what we eat.
Yeah.
We are what we think. Yeah. And I'll give you an example. If you think about sex all day, what do? You get horny.
Yeah.
Right? Oh, why? Yeah. Because it stimulates the glands down below in the sexual organs, right? So if you're stressed all day, what happens? Your stomach's churning, right? You're pumping cortisol through your body. If you feel compassionate and happy all day, what have you? You're in love, your heart, yeah. Right?
Yes.
So you know by how you're choosing to think and the information coming in is stressing you, those thoughts are figuring out what's churning in your stomach. And those stress hormones and cortisol keep you in your sympathetic nervous system. So if you're in stress, right, you can't be healing, right?
Yes.
So if you're just, like we said before, we live in a country with the most money in the world, but we take more prescription drugs than any other country in the world.
Yes.
Why? Because we're all stressed. But what are we stressed about? We live in comparison, Matt.
Yeah.
We've got comparison syndrome. We're looking at the next guy, the next thing, the next that, but what are we not? We're not here.
Right, because you never find true happiness if you're comparing yourself to others all the time. There's always going to be somebody with more than you, a better life than you, that doing that thing that maybe you want to do, and the best way is to be at peace with yourself. I mean, and it's something a lot of people have to work on, but it really has to be done because it's the only way. You have to stay in the moment. That's really it.
That's all we have. And then endorphins is pain. Okay? So we're all searching an endorphin run. That's why when people exercise, it spikes the endorphins in our brain. And that's where you get the runner's high. If you go out and run, you're going to feel good after a while. It takes a little time. That's why cardio is important.
Yeah.
Right? So someone asked me the other day, they're like, you know, dose and dopamine. I said, look, if you eat clean foods, when I mean clean, and there's a difference because people go, well, I'm a vegan and this is organic. I'm like, look, everything's processed. It comes from planet Earth. Some things are less processed than others.
Yes.
Let's just be honest.
Yeah.
It's organically from this planet.
Yeah.
But we know certain combinations aren't empowering. They mess us up, right? Yes.
Yeah, and it's really interesting you said that. I was talking to another guy we both know, Rob Zombie.
Oh.
Not that long ago. And Rob eats very clean. But he jokes around. He said, hey, you know, truth is you can be a vegan and get very fat.
There you go.
Because
you're eating fried food.
Because yeah.
And you're eating, processing
and stuff.
Yes. So here's the thing I always tell people. Unfortunately, American foods aren't the best. I can go to Australia and I have colitis, right? From the stress, the drugs, but yeah. I've healed it naturally. I can eat anything in Europe and in Australia. If I go to Italy, I can eat bread, pasta, anything I want all day and never get sick. Because you notice, if you eat bread in Europe or a croissant in Paris, in 1 or 2 days, it's done. You can leave a loaf of bread in America on the table for 2 weeks and it's still around because of the 30,000 preservatives.
Yes, exactly.
Right? So there's a big difference. I go to Australia and Kim, my wife's like, you are never sick in Australia. I'm like, look at the quality of the food. Now, I live in America. I'm American. I've been here half my life. There's 330 million people or whatever. There's only 28 million or 30 million people in Australia. It's a big difference.
Yes.
But my point is, you have to look at what you're consuming, right?
Yes.
And why you're consuming it, right? Yes. And here's another trick that people don't do. If you sit down and you take your time, and you prepare your meal for yourself, right? You cook it so you know what's in it, right? You don't have to eat a little protein, eat a little, I call it PVC, protein, vegetables, and little carbs, right? In that order so they all digest nicely. And you actually engage and chew your food correctly, like an animal would, right? Yeah. Properly. You build saliva in your mouth that creates the digestive enzyme in your gut.
Yes.
So you actually eat the food as fuel.
Yeah.
You're not eating 60 Big Macs while you're driving late for the sales meeting, getting an ulcer, drinking Pepto-Bismol, crapping your pants. Like, it's like, how? That's not fuel.
No, it's not.
Right?
It's,
so we're not. So someone said to me the other day, how could you be so fit? I said, well, I eat clean. I exercise. I said, I train. So when I'm 85, my son goes, Dad can still do more pull-ups than me. What a motherfucker.
Yeah.
That's for life.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's what training is. It's moving in harmony with your body.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Eating correctly. So there's no one way. Look, if you believe killing animals is wrong, be a vegan. But if you're eating fried tempura all day and you think it's better than the guy eating a grilled chicken and grilled salmon, you're wrong.
Yeah.
I don't know what you believe, like spiritually, if you believe, but eat clean.
Yeah.
Eat healthy foods. Eat small portions.
Yeah. Portions are a big part of what's...
No one needs to eat. No human being, unless you're Dean Karneses or David Goggins running ultras, right? I ran 30 half marathons in 30 days. I ran them fasted, Matt. I didn't eat.
I remember when you did
that. Yeah, and I didn't have a calorie in my body, and I was burning 1,600 to 1,800 calories running, and I didn't eat. So how the hell, so you see people sit down, and Morgan, our friend Morgan, did supersize me. No human being needs to eat 15, 16 ounces of red meat with potatoes unless you're a strong man.
Yeah,
you're going back to your office. Where are you burning that?
Exactly. Like, that's really what it comes down to.
Your fucking mind.
Yeah.
You're sitting there like...
Exactly.
Right.
I mean, it's certainly not good for you. And it's amazing what people can do. I mean,
I guarantee you this, and I can prove this to people. I fast 16 hours a day, right?
Yeah.
I went to Hawaii with my wife, and I never get off my diet, and I don't eat restaurant food very rarely. I got so sick there and I was eating clean, but it's because they oils, don't put it in oil, whatever, right? I said to my wife, I don't feel good. I was really physically ill there. I had inflammation in my hips, my body. I felt like arthritic. I'm a fit guy. I got home to my wife. I said, I need to fast for 2 days. She goes, wait a minute. I said, I can't eat food for 48 hours. All I did is drink water. I said, I need to get all this shit out of my body. 2 days later, all I did is drink water and that's it. Just because your body can fast. Everything went away. All the pain. And it was all because I'd never eaten the preservatives in the foods because I wasn't used to eating restaurant food.
Yeah.
But I was that I was that sore. Like just from changing my diet for 7 days. And it was clean. It was still chicken breast. It was still rice. It wasn't shitty like McDonald's, but even the restaurant food messed me up.
Yeah, it's funny. That's what my girlfriend will say to me. She goes, you know what? When we make food at home, it's so much better because you don't use all the oils and the butter and all those other things that are added in it.
You know what's in it.
Yeah. You know, because you're actually preparing it yourself.
Yeah. It'll make you sick.
Yeah. And if you don't have to, you know, if you find yourself, you know, in a situation where you are limited in time, you can prepare more. That's what I ended up doing at a certain period where I was just going and saying, all right, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to make sure I have stuff prepared so it's ready so I don't have to be scrambling and then go for something really.
Yeah. If you're hungry, you're just going to eat what's in front of you. That's why fast food is the king in America.
Yeah.
Driveways are the king.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, they are.
I mean, it's franchise and Driveways. You can pull in, get a horrible meal, feel shitty about yourself all day, right? Watch a bunch of bad TV, right? Watch the news, feel like you want to blow your brains off. Then at 3 a.m, they're like, are you feeling depressed? Are you feeling lonely? Maybe we have the pill for you. And it's the lady in the golden retriever. You're like, that's my fucking pill.
Yeah.
That'll help me, right?
Yeah.
It's like your subconscious in your programming. And you step back and go, wait a second. What's the information I'm bringing in?
Yeah.
Right?
Absolutely.
There's two things that anyone has. This is the simplest thing, right?
Yeah.
If you have consistency and some self-discipline and you can delay a little gratification and you could look at someone like yourself, for example, that's successful in an area and model your behavior, you're going to be successful. And I'll tell you why. You look at a guy like Dave Grohl. And you know what Dave Grohl said? They're like, did you have drum lessons? He said, I paid $30 for a drum lesson. And the guy told me I was holding the sticks wrong. He said, I can't afford that. I'll figure it out myself.
Yeah. It's amazing.
They said, how do you do with the guitar? And he goes, a couple of lessons. I figured it out for myself.
Yeah.
You see my point? It's like, if you're willing to do the work and you can see people that have done it and they're successful, And day by day, it's just a micro process. A little bit every day, I get better. And I get my rituals and routines down, and I stay a little consistent, and I manage my state by doing some breath work, and I respond, not react. And then you look back over 12 months, like guys like us that are sober, you're like, holy shit, my life's pretty good.
Yeah. And you're very grateful.
Yeah. For that, right? I'm paying my bills. I'm not in a club at 4 a.m. having some girl say, hey, why don't you snort cocaine off my titties? I'll make you the strongest guy in the world.
Exactly.
Right? Yeah. Like doing dumb shit.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Like now it's like someone says to me, is your life hard? I say, it's not hard because I choose my heart. And they go, what do you mean? I said, look, there's the guy that's overweight, right? It's hard for him to be fit. Then there's the guy that's fit. It's hard for him to stay in shape.
Yeah.
Choose your heart.
Yeah, choose what your heart is and what that love.
It's going to be hard either way. It's still hard for me to get up at 3 a.m.
Yeah.
And train. It's no different how fit I am. It's still the next day.
Yeah. It's just true.
Choose your heart.
Yeah. I love that.
Choose your heart.
Yeah, that is brilliant. I got to tell you how excited I am about the book, and I want people to be able to know where they can get it. Also, you know what? Like I said, one of the things that I saw that you posted recently that I loved, we were just talking about, like, what are your jobs that you have? Being a positive human being.
Being a good human being. I say to people, it's just something that someone came to me the other day, and you'll agree with this because you've known me a long time, and they're like, you know, you may have been a fucking crazy crackhead and done some crazy shit, but deep down, you're just a good person. And I am a good person, and my son is magical. He's beautiful. He's a good kid, right?
Yeah.
And I was like, yeah. I was like, I've always been a good. I made a lot of bad choices out of trauma and anger and trying to show off. But deep down, I like people. So what I say to people is like, wherever you go in the world, there's people, right? And there's a recession-proof job, and you're always going to have a job because always going to be people if you sign up for the job of being a good human being.
Yeah. Absolutely.
That's it. Just be a good fucking person.
Yeah.
Be kind. Be compassionate. Be empathetic. Meet people where they are. Know that we all have different information because we're all born in different places. We have different upbringings and environments. Some people don't have the information we have, but just be kind.
Yeah.
And if they're struggling, instead of saying, fuck that person, say, how can I help you?
Yeah, I agree 100%.
How can I make you feel a little better than you are today? And if you can go around, Matt, you know what one thing I do, Matt? I don't post about it. I go into my grocery store every week, and I'm pretty good at picking out who's struggling. I don't struggle. And I'll find someone. I'll go, hey, how's your day going? And I know they're going to tell me because I can see by their body language. Like, it's pretty fucked. Why? And I'm like, well, when was the last time someone did something nice and kind to you? And they'll tell me, oh, I don't even remember. That's just bullshit. I said, well, how about this? I'll buy you groceries this week. And they look at me like, are you fucking serious? Because I know people live check by check.
Yeah.
And they're like, what do you want from me? This is what I want from you. The next person you meet, be kind.
Yeah.
And if I do that to one person, the compound interest, one person a week, 52 weeks in a year, right?
Yeah.
Over the years, the amount of people that just, I drop a little dose of positivity on them, all they do is they have a better day and they pass it on to the next and they have faith that there's good people in the world again.
Yeah.
That's all it is.
That's really important too. It so is because there are good people.
Yeah.
It's a matter of finding
them. Of course there is.
But spreading that positivity and doing something kind.
We don't have to be a dick, man.
Yeah. It seems to take too much energy, in my opinion. Like more energy. Not that I've been a dick to people, but you know.
I can admit it. I made bad choices. I was a dick.
Yeah.
I was selfish.
I certainly was definitely when I was drinking and using because it's your selfishness. You know what I mean? And my selfishness. And a lot of times I don't even remember to be honest with you. And I'm sure I said some things I would not be proud of today, but which is something you learn to forgive yourself for and you move past it and you just try to be a good human being from that.
That's it.
Moment on. I'm not saying I was never a dick, but you know what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not that I can remember, but then again, I guess that's the one thing about alcoholism.
not every know. Time.
Well, put it this way. I will say this, that the disease makes you selfish. And that's the thing. I will admit that I was selfish. I wasn't thinking of others when I was deciding to make a choice to miss something or not be there for somebody that I loved or cared about or for somebody else with work. That was, that's being extremely selfish because, you know, you're affecting other people's lives and days and that's not cool,
no.
You know, but you can do something about it. You can change your life and that's the most important thing in the world. And that I feel good about because I'm grateful to be here. And I just figure every day from this day on, because I can't do anything about the past, and I do it today, and I'll do it tomorrow, is be good, always be kind, and try and help others. That's really what it is.
You know, it's so funny. Someone said to me, and I can be honest, they said, why do you do interventions? And like, oh, shouldn't just people walk into meetings? I said, you know, here's the difference. I was a little ignorant because I walked into a meeting, right, in New York. I was like, I'll go to meetings. I had great people around me that took me to meetings. I said, but here's the difference. When someone is making a really bad choice and it becomes an unconscious competence, and what I mean by that is that there is certain habits, like you wake up a certain way, like you getting on the air and doing stuff, that's an unconscious competence.
Yeah.
You don't have to, it's like when you drive, right, you get in the car, once you learn to drive, you can go 19 exits past your place and go, where was I? The body was driving the car.
Yeah.
Sometimes the body drives us and we don't even know that we're caught in a bad habit. And if you have limited choices and you have no mentors and you have abuse around you and you come from like the inner city or you're beaten down and you're abused and you've suffered mental illness, you don't know there's a better way.
Yeah.
And if a guy like me walks into your life as an interventionist and intervenes and then says, hey, you're struggling right now, but I'm going to present you, and I'm loving and kind, with a better opportunity. Why don't you just try my opportunity for a little period of time and let's see if we can get you into a safer environment and maybe you can get clean. And then from there, we take it day by day, right? Because that's all I do in an intervention. I create a loving environment for someone to heal. And if it's family, I teach them about how addiction is a family disease and the cycle. People, I go to someone, that's not a sponsor, man. That's not walking someone in the meeting. That's an intervention.
Yeah.
What I do is different.
Yeah.
And they're like, well, I didn't look at it like that. I said, because not everyone knows they can go into a meeting. And if you're doing fentanyl, you can't just walk into a fucking AA meeting. You need a medical detox and you need good people around you.
You do.
Right?
Yeah. If you're doing a lot of cocaine.
Correct.
Crystal meth.
Yeah.
Even too much alcohol, which, you know, if you
can die.
You can die. You can die of a seizure.
Exactly. So I try to explain to people when they say, oh, yeah, I go, look. Helping someone and intervening, sometimes you have to intervene because the person doesn't know any better.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's actually being of service.
It is.
It's not bullying someone. It's saying, no. The choices you're making now are going to kill you.
Yeah.
You're sick and suffering. Let me show you a better way.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And that's some people like in the AO, oh yeah, but they should just walk into meetings. It doesn't work like that.
No, it doesn't. It's not that simple.
No.
And, everybody has their way that they like to look at things, but I agree with yours. I think, and that's the most important thing.
We all need help.
Yeah.
Help someone.
I definitely got, that was the important thing for me is the people that rallied around me. And then I surrounded myself with good people in the program that were loving and caring and were honest with me. And, and I love that about them that it was, and if they thought there was some bullshit, they call you out on your shit sometimes, you know, but most of the time it's about kindness because that, telling you the truth is actually doing you a favor because you know the famous line, bad news doesn't get good with age. And you know, so it's like,
that's
you
so
know,
good.
It's so, you know, it's, but I, you know, I'm so grateful. Mike, I want to thank you so much for coming in and doing this.
No.
Tell people how they can get in touch with you, your websites and, the book. Let's talk
about it. So the website is themikediamond.com. Instagram and social media is themike_diamond. I'm on all the social media. You can buy the book in stores. If you're in LA, it's The Grove. It's actually here in the Galleria in Glendale, Glendora, a bunch of places in Southern Cal. If you're in New York, hey, you can go to Union Square, Barnes & Nobles. I don't know how I got in there, but I did. 5th Avenue, 82nd Street. And then, of course, Amazon is king. You can always get it on Amazon.
Yeah.
But I really want, if anyone is listening to this and if you're sick and suffering, you can email me or you can send me a direct message. I actually check my messages. And if I can't help you, I can definitely guide you to make a better choice or if you're in another state, help you out. So don't suffer in silence. You know, reach out to someone like me and just send me a message. I check messages all the time. People tell me they want to kill themselves or they're sicker and suffering, and I always reach back. And you're not alone. We're all suffering day by day. We're just doing our best to make a better choice.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Mike, this has been great. I loved having you here. Once again, check out and please get Mike's book. It's called A Dose of Positivity, Tools, Techniques, and Strategies to Live Life on Your Terms from Mike Diamond. Mike, it was great to have you here. So great to have
you. I love you, brother. Thank you so much.
Love you too, man. It's so good to see you come in today. If you like this week's episode, please subscribe to our podcast and make sure that you give us a great review. Either way, most important thing is that we're here of service and we're helping you out or helping out someone you know. If you know someone who is struggling, make sure that you are there for them and let them know that they're not alone. And that's this week's Sound Sobriety and Success. I'm Matt Pinfield. Thanks so much for listening. If you or someone you know is struggling with alcoholism or addiction, Music Cares operates a mental health and addiction recovery program that understands the challenges music professionals face, no matter where they are in their career. Learn more, including if you're eligible, at musiccares.org. That's musiccares.org.
Sound, Sobriety, and Success with Matt Pinfield. Produced by Jake Urbanek. Engineered by Darren Silva. Jerry Ansaldo, Booking. Bill Royal, Research. Susan Axu, Marketing Production Assistant. And Laura Keeney, Marketing. Sound, Sobriety, and Success is a Bennstown McVeigh podcast production.